You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. Most of us go to the doctor expecting to feel better after, but we don't spend much time thinking about how we get high-quality care. How do we make sure our health system is safe? To find out, we're joined by Catherine McDonald, an expert in patient safety and quality at Stanford Health Policy. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So I think it's safe to say we've all been patients before, and I think most of us here in the U.S. feel pretty safe when we go to the doctor. So why should we care about patient safety? Should we be worried?
Well, you know, when I started out doing research in this area, I was rather naive and didn't know all the things that could go wrong. It was about 15 years ago, and I was working with colleagues at UCSF and Stanford on a report called Making Healthcare Safer. And it was really the beginning of the patient safety movement, where the National Academies of Medicine, then called the Institute of Medicine, was concerned about patient safety and did a major report that showed that the number of deaths that were due to potentially preventable harm that came to people while they were in the healthcare system was upwards towards 100,000 deaths per year, or the equivalent of a jumbo jet going down every day. And that caught attention and made it a national priority. But as I said, I didn't have any idea what really happened, what that really meant. And as I started working on this research project with three doctors, I learned what kinds of failures happen and what the targets of improving patient safety are. So things like having your lung punctured by accident while some part of your anatomy inside of your chest is being accessed for care that it needs to be accessed for. So somebody's going into your chest some way that they need to go into your chest, but the lung gets punctured accidentally. And it can deflate, and that's an emergency, and that's a harm that can be potentially preventable with certain methods that can be used as somebody's, you know, as their chest is being, you know, entered.
Yeah, so, yeah, that certainly sounds like something we'd prefer to avoid.
Absolutely.
So what are the kinds of things that happen perhaps frequently that most of us don't know about, you know, stories like that, that would perhaps make us be a little more concerned?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the challenge with safety and thinking about safety and doing it in a way that's constructive and not, you know, in a way that is so worrisome is the recognition that there's actually a lot of different types of harms that can happen. Each harm isn't happening all that frequently. And that's the real challenge. So it's not that, you know, there really aren't very many times that, say, a foreign object is left inside of the body during surgery. That's one of the ones that's gotten a lot of attention over the years. A sponge may be being left in. Now, the healthcare systems, the delivery systems, the operating rooms have come up with strategies to reduce the chance of that. It wasn't happening very much to begin with, but it was happening. And we think that that shouldn't happen at all. So these things that are never events happen infrequently. So that idea of like a foreign object being left in, I was looking up the numbers recently from the OECD, the Organization of Economics and Cooperation and Development, an international organization. They put numbers up for patient safety events like foreign, you know, body left in. And the numbers sort of worldwide range from about 1 to 12 per 100,000. So depending on what country you're in, your risk of that foreign body might only be 1 in 100,000. But it can range up to 12 in 100,000. And 12 out of 100,000 might not sound that like that much, but for those 12 people, it's, you know, it's significant. And if the system could actually make it possible to never have that happen, that would be better. For other types of events that happen, harms that happen to patients, the numbers can be higher. So for example, you can get a clot after a surgery. And clotting is good if, you know, you have a cut, but inside the body, clots can actually be thrown and end up causing strokes. So when surgery is done, if a clot starts to form internally and moves in the body, that can be really dangerous. And there's strategies to reduce the chance of a person having a clot. And those numbers, like worldwide, are range from 30 to 800 of those per 100,000, depending on what country you live in. So those are a few of the many targets. On that project I was talking to you about, there were 80 patient safety targets, so 80 different types of harms that we were trying to find evidence about how you could reduce the risk of those harms.
Yeah, no, 800 per 100,000 sounds like a much bigger number than 12, so that's really interesting. So you work with patient safety and quality. What's the difference between safety and quality?
That's a great question. There are various arguments sometimes about this, and they really don't matter at all, because patient safety is this idea that there's actually a harm that the healthcare system caused. The patient came into the healthcare system. If they hadn't come into the healthcare system, they would never have that harm. It wouldn't just be precipitated out of their body, as they're walking around. Quality includes safety as one of the components of quality. But quality is a broader concept, and it has to do with what sort of the standard that we think we can meet as a healthcare delivery system, and are we meeting it every time? One of the examples of this would be if you believe that patients should always hear what they should do as they're discharged from the hospital when they get home, and they're not given those types of discharge instructions, then that would be a quality failure. And you can measure, basically, how frequently does that happen, that a patient doesn't get their discharge information, that what they need to do when they get home, what warning signs they need to look for, because that would be a quality thing. What types of medications they need, how they need to take their medications, that's a quality thing. Whether they get a medication they're supposed to get, that's a quality thing. Whether they're screened for something that they need to be screened for, is that happening consistently? And we know that it doesn't happen consistently. There have been studies that show that 50% of care that's known to be good for patients doesn't happen, even though everyone agrees that it should happen.
Yeah. Now, I can certainly see how that sort of thing would happen. I remember, back when I was a kid and got my wisdom teeth out, they did give me information on what I was supposed to do after, but I was so out of it that it was days before I actually read it. So I would think also, how the information is conveyed to people probably makes a big difference.
Yeah, and that's really important. And this is where, some people will define quality more along the lines of, that there's this standard where we know there's really good evidence that if you, say in that example, if you take a patient who, it sounds very sensible, if you take a patient who isn't really out of their anesthetic fog or has been a little traumatized by a procedure, and you give them information and they don't remember it, that doesn't sound like the best quality, which it's not. It's not. So, just kind of the reasonable person test is a very patient-centered way of thinking about quality. The medical way of thinking of it sometimes has more to do with saying there's something that we know that when we do it, that we're sure that improves a person's outcome. Mm-hmm. And then we want to make sure we're doing all those things all the time.
Great. So I think we may have answered this question a little bit, but why does quality matter? I think we all want to have high quality care, but with everything we hear about how high healthcare costs are already, I certainly hope I'm already getting pretty good care at my doctor's office. So why would I be concerned about quality?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons. I think maybe starting with even a broader definition of quality might help us. So the broader definition of quality gets at, is it equitable? Is everybody who needs to have high quality care actually getting it? Do people have access to that? And while you and I might go to the doctor and be at an organization that has been able to focus a lot on improving their quality over the years and continues to improve it, there's many instances where The healthcare delivery system is very strapped for resources, and the patient's situations are such that it's much harder to assure that that quality is delivered and available. I've done some studies with some folks at UCSF that focus on ambulatory care. That means care outside of the hospital. And there, there's a real concern for the potential for not being able to get a patient to come back in for follow-up care that's needed and maybe missing a cancer diagnosis. And we would all agree that that isn't a good thing. Yet, you know, is that the institution's responsibility? Is that the patient's responsibility? How do you think about that to end up with quality? It's challenging. Another thing you mentioned was about kind of cost. And if you think about an expanded definition of quality as including efficiency, not having waste, resources that aren't used for one person or for one system aren't available for another. And we are at a time where healthcare costs in the United States especially are incredibly high compared to other countries. And we, on the metrics that exist to compare quality across different countries, the U.S. does not do all that well. So we spend more, and we don't necessarily get higher quality.
So I think that leads us to the next question. How do we improve or, you know, even maintain the quality and safety that we do have?
Yeah, you know, and this is kind of the holy grail if you're doing research in this area, is where are the biggest leverage points? And the way I think about both safety and quality as related concepts, I think about, we have a complicated human body. It's got a lot of systems, and it's got a lot of kind of chemistry going on. We don't, you know, medical science doesn't know everything about the human body. It knows a lot. And the healthcare delivery system, doctors and nurses and other healthcare professions and professionals and their, you know, the organizations that surround them want to take that knowledge about the body and use that to provide care that will alleviate suffering, you know, reduce the chance of death, etc. But as they do that, they have to optimize. You know, they have to try to decide who gets what when. The professionals, are they trained in the way they need to be trained to see the particular patients they need to see? All of that seems very, very straightforward, and that we, just like everything that we do in the world, that, you know, you can get shoes delivered, you know, a few hours later. you can go to the grocery store and see all the, you know, food on the shelves. That there's plenty that kind of works in the world. Same thing with healthcare. But you have this complicated body, you have a bunch of medical knowledge, it's always changing, and then you have a workforce that is highly specialized, and you have organizations that are many different settings. You have the emergency room, the urgent care, the outpatient setting, the hospital, many settings. Those all influence what happens in that encounter, whether it's in the doctor's office or, you know, in the emergency room or in a hospital room. So all of those moments where there's an interaction between what's called the healthcare system, meaning actual people within the healthcare system, and the patient, are shaped by those organizational forces. And then the organizations and what they can do are shaped by the wider environment, regulations, what the financial streams are, how they get to the delivery system. So it's all of that. All of that affects quality and safety, not just what one doctor does in one moment.
So how does policy play into this? How is the government involved in making sure that we receive good quality and safety?
Yeah, that's very important. That is that shaper of the organizations and the delivery system. In the U.S. context, you know, we have had laws related to quality and safety. We have the current Affordable Care Act or any other health care reform that's underway. There's a lot changing. So in the current situation, there's been an emphasis on value and having experiments to try to understand demonstration projects, what can give us quality and, you know, lower cost at the same time. So lots of those experiments require a way of being able to measure whether you're getting quality. So things like the rate of mortality for patients who have particular procedures, how patient experience works when they're in a healthcare setting. So some of these demonstration projects, there'll be new models of care, maybe better ways of coordinating care across settings where there's some real risk that information won't flow. And then the question is, do you have that population of patients that are being cared for in the delivery system in a way that's being monitored at the national level as a sort of a test for can we do better? Those populations of patients are monitored to see if they have higher percentages of being on the medications they're supposed to be on, if they have if more of them are under control, if say it's a chronic illness like hypertension, is what the healthcare delivery system's trying to do, how they organize themselves to get more quality, do they end up with better results? One of the lead agencies that's responsible for helping generate evidence and move that evidence into practice is the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. They're under Health and Human Services. They've recently have a major program going on called ARCS Evidence Now, setting the target for improving heart health in America. And this is sort of a multi-pronged effort to improve heart health. Lots of quality interventions end up being multi-pronged. It's not just one small change in the healthcare delivery system. So this project that ARC has going, they've called it the ABCs of heart health, and they're trying to make sure that aspirin use, which is something that lots of people are on aspirin to prevent heart attacks, a small little bit of aspirin. However, there are also lots of people who, if they were on aspirin, that would be better for them, but they're not. And so the current level of aspirin use in those who it could be beneficial for is 65%. So 65% of those in whom it would be beneficial are actually getting aspirin prescribed or using it. And so, for this program, this Evidence Now program that starts at what's the evidence? What do we actually, know is good? They'd like the goal to be 70%. And so they're working with the healthcare delivery system to figure out how do you get, more patients who need to be on aspirin to use it. And then they're also looking at blood pressure control. Again, the idea is to go from a current 62% of patients who need to have good blood pressure control up to 70%. These aren't huge leaps, but they're actually hard to achieve. And if they could be achieved, a lot of lives would actually be affected by that. Can that be achieved at a reasonable cost? These are the kinds of questions that are being driven by healthcare reforms that say that the healthcare delivery system has to be accountable for patients' health in a way that, will mean that we'll save more lives and have less suffering. So back to the ABCs of heart health, it was aspirin use, blood pressure control, cholesterol management, and smoking cessation support. Each has a target. And each has, if you can move that target up, you would save more lives. And that's the challenge that ARC is undertaking, using methods that have been shown to change people's, behavior. Because sometimes it's the clinician's behavior that they don't think to do the next step because maybe they're doing 10 other things. Sometimes it's the patient's behavior. They don't understand enough or they have enough, conflicting priorities. And the strategies that try to, change that behavior, none of us has an easy time changing our behavior. So lots of these projects, the whole idea is that policy can push and incentivize for systems to figure out how they can get the behaviors they want to see that then result in being able to achieve the levels of use of effective prescriptions, effective procedures, effective coaching, whatever's known to be effective, how do you make sure that it always gets to the patient?
Right. So then what can we do to make sure that these things are actually happening? Are there any specific policies or, you know, anything along those lines that we could do to make safe or to make things safer for patients?
Yeah. You know, another area of a lot of action is around measurement. I've been talking about the types of targets that are out there and the amount of the frequency of patient safety problems. We could do a lot better if we had a great set of measures. So if we could just imagine, you know, what is it that all patients, you know, want? Well, they don't want to be harmed. They don't want to have their quality of life affected when it wouldn't have to be affected. So if we could look at exactly what sort of all people would see as sort of the ideal, and we could measure that really well, and we could make sure that we're monitoring that in a way that gives us the constant feedback loop of when we as a system of healthcare delivery or healthcare policymaking are making that harder, then we would make more progress than we've made, perhaps. Then again, we've actually been making a lot of progress. So the good news is that with efforts like AHRQs, with the efforts that have gone on within the Medicare program and the Medicaid program, various policy level programs, the good news is that there's building evidence that, say, from 2010 to 2015, that more than 3 million hospital-acquired conditions were prevented. So these kinds of things like the punctured lung, an infection that's like a pneumonia that you get because you were on a ventilator. And so, you know, 3 million, you know, less of these types of effects, patient harms, is evidence that the focus, you know, the concerted focus on patient safety and quality is paying off. In terms of lives saved, the estimates are at 125,000 over that 5 years. We'd be really happy if that was, you know, an effect that we'd see for like heart attack patients. So this is great. And the associated savings have been estimated to be almost $30 billion over that same 5 years by averting those types of, you know, healthcare acquired conditions, those patient safety harms that are now the focus of a lot of healthcare systems. Over the years that I've worked on this, we've gone from not even being able to articulate what a patient safety target would be to being able to say, you know, here's a list of many things you can do to try to reduce this harm.
That's great. And be hopeful that those trends will continue.
Yeah, it'll keep taking a lot of focus. I mean, it is uphill because the system is complicated. The way that policies play out within the system are complicated. And then, of course, as I said, the human body is pretty complicated too.
Absolutely. Before we go, most people probably don't know this, but you and I used to work together. And around the office, you know, people were always saying, "Where's Kathy?" because you're traveling a lot to learn and talk about these kinds of issues. So now that we have you here with us, you can't escape.
in podcast land.
Here in podcast land. Could you tell us about the most interesting place that you've been this year?
Well, I got to head over to Australia, which has been a leader in patient safety, actually, in both figuring out that there's problems with patient safety and their solutions. I went for the first conference in Australia and in that region of the world on diagnostic error in medicine. I had never been to Australia, so I was very, very much looking forward to the trip and pleased to see a world city that I hadn't seen before. In Melbourne, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong, Australia. I didn't have enough time to see the city because it was the conference included many, many physicians who are very dedicated to improving their systems so that patients end up with the best possible quality and safety around diagnosis, which is an emerging area of safety and quality that I'm very invested in and care about a lot.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Catherine McDonald, for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful, and I hope this gives the audience a little bit of a taste for quality and safety and the types of activity that are going on.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. To learn more about patient safety and quality, visit our website at healthpolicy.fsi.stanford.edu or follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.